Hi, I'm Jay from San Diego.
I'm Chase from Seattle.
I'm Jamie from New York City.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You know, sometimes the experience that pushes a performer towards show business happens early.
Imagine, if you will, being 6 feet tall by third grade. So essentially being like a living maypole. And who, by the way, kids did dance around me in a circle. Multiple occasions. Not even on May 1st. It's a good day to dance around a maypole. But it also made me relatively confident, which is weird because I guess I just felt like nothing worse going to happen than this.
It's Bullseye. This week, Aisha Tyler from that most tremendous of television programs, Archer. Bullseye correspondent Jordan Morris puts America in its place, literally, by ranking things. And David Hornsby talks about playing a defrocked priest turned drug addict on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And now, a surprisingly altruistic teenager on his new animated show, Unsupervised. It's the good stuff and just the good stuff in pop culture this week on Bullseye. Let's go. Let's kick things off with some culture recommendations from our friends at the AV Club this week. Joining me are Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky in Chicago. Scott, what have you got for us?
My pick is the new film, We Need to Talk About Kevin. It's directed by Lynn Ramsey, and it's based on a novel by Lionel Shriver about a woman who's dealing with the aftermath of her son's Columbine-like school massacre. Though the film and the book reference Columbine, the most troubling aspect of both may be their portraits of maternal ambivalence. This is a child she does not want.
Okay, here's a clip that takes place before the tragedy. It's got Tilda Swinton, John C. Reilly, and Ezra Miller as the titular Kevin.
So, Kev, Mom had something that she wanted to tell you.
I wanted to thank you for calling the ambulance.
And
I was concerned that you might be feeling responsible.
Why's that?
Because you were supposed to be looking after her.
We just don't want you to blame yourself.
No, I don't. I mean, I never said I did.
She's going to need a glass eye, Kevin.
So we would appreciate you looking out for her and any name-calling.
You don't really remember being a kid much, do you, Dad? Celia's just going to have to suck it up.
Is it weird that I find Tilda Swinton pretty much unsettling no matter what, like even on the red carpet?
Yeah, it's not weird. It's not weird. And she is unsettling here. She's about the opposite of motherly, I would say, in this movie.
Genevieve, what have you got for us this week?
I want to talk about Lock and Key, which is a comic book series that recently released its 28th issue at the end of December. It's basically a large-scale haunted house story about these three kids who move into a sprawling mansion called Key House, and they gradually discover that the house is littered with these keys that have different powers of varying degrees of evilness.
Do you have a favorite key?
Oh, yeah, the head key. It allows you to open up your head and look inside and root around and put things in and take them out as you choose.
Wait, what can you put into and take out of your head?
You can, like, put an entire book's worth of knowledge, or you can take out your sense of fear or things like that. Then.
The author of this thing has, let's just say, a relative in the industry.
Yeah, he definitely has some horror credentials. It's written by Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's son. He actually released a horror novel called Heart-Shaped Box in 2007, and he just won the Eisner Award in 2011 for Best Writer for Lock and Key.
The Eisner Award is like the number one most prestigious comic book award you can win, right?
Yeah, it's like the Academy Awards of comic books.
Scott Tobias's pick this week is the new film We Need to Talk About Kevin, which has a staged release this month. Genevieve Kosky picked the comic series Lock and Key, with a new issue out January 25th. You can find Scott and Genevieve at avclub.com.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Aisha Tyler, is maybe the world's prettiest funny black geek lady, or the geekiest black funny pretty lady, or some kind of combination of those words that I haven't said yet, because I'm not just going to go through all of the possible combinations of those words, because it would be a waste of all of our time.
6,758.
Yeah. She was the host of Talk Soup. She was a regular on Friends and CSI and 24, maybe like the most popular television shows ever. She's one of the panelists on CBS's The Talk. On her podcast, Girl on Guy, she talks about guy stuff with both guys and women. Let it not be said that she doesn't talk about guy stuff with women on that show. She's also one of the stars of one of my absolute favorite television programs on television, Archer, on FX, where she plays Lana, the most competent of the incompetent spies on the show. Here she is in a scene from Archer. She is arguing with the titular Archer, played by John Benjamin. He is, well, he's often surprisingly competent. he's a sort of idiot savant spy. In this scene, they're trying to break into a palace on one of their missions, and Archer is manning the computer keyboard as they try to pull up the palace's schematics.
So let's assume we can't access the palace through that same skylight.
Okay.
But maybe we overlooked an air shaft, or maybe even some access below grade. So let's pull up the palace schematics.
Okay.
Maybe today.
Hang on.
If that works for you.
Let me see. How about now? Anything?
No.
How about now?
No.
How about now?
No.
Anything?
What are you doing back there?
I don't know.
What are you, just hitting random keys?
Well, obviously.
Ah, damn it. Wait. Where is the hobbit guy?
A freaking hobbit works here?
No, he's just
Lana,
a...
they're called little people,
will
not
you
hobbits.
He's a hobbit enthusiast.
Oh.
Well, yeah, but he also knows how to work all the computers and satellites and...
Aisha Tyler, welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you for having me.
We are both San Francisco natives. I am excited always to have a San Franciscan on the show.
Yes, we have a strange kind of spidey sense.
Yeah. I think it would be fair to say that we have a special spitey sense.
Yes, and a spitey
with a T,
sense.
Yeah, yes. towards Southern California.
Well, I went home recently and I did a show where I just mocked everybody in San Francisco because I had drunk up all their fresh water.
You were born in San Francisco, mm-hmm. but raised, I think, in large part in the East Bay, right?
Yes, back and forth between San Francisco and the East Bay. Yeah, like I was born in the city and lived in the East Bay until I was in freshman year in high school, went back to San Francisco and finished high school in San Francisco.
Your folks divorced when you were relatively young, mm-hmm. and you were raised by your dad, mm-hmm. which is kind of an unusual thing to
it
have
is,
your... I mean,
yeah.
My folks divorced when I was relatively young, and I split time, and even that was relatively unusual.
Yeah, women always seem to get, I don't know, is it the long end or the short end of the lottery?
I mean, it depends on the kid.
It depends on the time of day, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're like, this is a joy. Other times you're like, maybe you'll just disappear for a while. My parents, you know, it's a nouveau riche thing to be sending the kids back and forth on weekends. Poor people just go, how much can you afford? Can you afford one? Can you afford two? Just take that one. You take the sofa. I'll take the TV. Goodbye. You know what I mean? There's no Kramer versus Kramer. When you can barely afford groceries. So my parents just each took one because that was what they could manage. And it worked out great. And my dad took me because I was older and I could cook for him. So.
Wait, what did you cook for your dad?
I had a very limited repertoire. I could make fried eggs. I could make spinach, frozen spinach out of a bag. My father's specialty was my father. Men are like one pot casserole cookers, you know, and this was kind of before like the real kind of modern TV dinner era. So my father had this specialty that was rice-a-roni with chopped up chicken and raisins and spinach all stirred into the pot. And I must have eaten rice-a-roni and like a whole stick of butter. I ate rice-a-roni. I mean, it's amazing I didn't have, you know, the gout or rickets or something like that, or scurvy.
I guess one of the central mysteries that I was trying to figure out as I was learning about you in preparing for this interview was, connecting the dots between you being good-looking enough to star in and host television programs and identifying as a geek.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to go back further. And when my parents were still married, we lived in the East Bay, and they scraped and saved my mom. You know, they were really lower working class, you know, didn't have a lot of money, but they were both very focused on education. So they scraped and they saved, and they sent me to private school. And I was the only black kid in my school for almost all of my childhood until I was a teenager. So if you imagine, if you will, being 6 feet tall by third grade. So essentially being like a living maypole, and who, by the way, kids did dance around me in a circle multiple occasions, even not even on May 1st. Just any it's a good day to dance around a maypole.
Wait, are you telling me that these kids weren't even just observing May Day?
No.
We just, know just that kids will observe May Day with whatever tall object happens to be
kids
around.
Will collect ribbons and they will build a maypole without you don't have to bid them to do it. That's it's
certainly.
they feel it in the air.
If they're medievalists or they're international socialists.
Time to
certainly.
Make a daisy crown. But, you know, just on a random Thursday, let's dance around the big girl. So I was the only black kid in my school. My parents were poor. So, you know, kind of all of the social cues that were important when you're a kid, you know, the right clothes, the right shoes, you know, when Nikes came out and everybody had Nikes and I had, shoes that my mother had found in a free box. And they, you know, one was a knit booty and one was a flip flop. So there was that. And then when I went home, I lived in a black neighborhood and I talked, you know, in their minds like a white kid and they thought I was fancy and putting on airs. And yes, I did get jumped every few months in that neighborhood as well. You know, it did two things. It made me an isolated kid, but it also made me relatively confident, which is weird because I guess I just felt like nothing worse can happen than this. So, you know, I just figured like, I'll just put myself out there because it can't get any worse than it's already gotten.
You mentioned your surprising confidence. I want to play a clip for you and then talk a little bit about it. This is actually from your high school years.
Oh no! From the steps, I could hear they'd already started. It was Saturday morning, and I overslept, so now I was really late to these auditions. Channel 7 was doing a story on us, School of the Arts, S-O-T-A, you know, SOTA. We're part of McAteer High, and people are calling us the San Francisco Fame.
Dance with me, I want to be your partner, can't you see? Music is the start.
They were casting a student to be the narrator, someone with humongous talent and personality.
Oh, God, that was just physically painful, I have to say. Physically painful.
That is this TV documentary. I guess they said Channel 7, so I'm guessing it must have been from KGO. We got it from the internet. Mm-hmm. About the high school that you attended, which at the time was at was a sort of sub high school at McAteer High School in San Francisco, and later became an independent high school.
Yeah.
This is the part where I say I'm also a graduate of that high school.
Oh, how exciting! You went there?
Yeah, I went to School of the Arts, and in fact met my wife there.
Oh, that's adorable.
People would sometimes ask me then, and even now, like, was it like Fame? Like, were there people singing and dancing in the hallways?
Kind of. I felt
yeah,
like
people
were.
Did. Yeah, yeah, people totally did. When I was in, yeah, people totally, I would just say, yeah, I mean, it wasn't choreographed. It was more spontaneous than that.
No, I feel like there would be like dance-offs like in the courtyard and stuff like that. You would go and people would just start dancing. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as ridiculous as it sounds. But yes, it was very Fame-like. And then there were a lot of, we had some really great graphic artists and they would do murals and stuff like that. And they would paint people's jackets. And that does sound ridiculous. Yeah, no, but it was very arty.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Aisha Tyler. She's one of the stars of the animated FX show Archer. Early in your career, did you play what they call black rooms? Did you play the Chocolate Thursdays and the
my comedy is not particularly niche in that way.
That's why I ask.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, my friend Al Madrigal he's of mixed race. His dad is Mexican American, but he reads visually as Latino,
mm-hmm.
and he actually just got a full time job as the senior Latino correspondent on The Daily Show.
That's so great.
I know he's great.
Oh,
he's
good for him.
He's totally brilliant. And he sometimes does Latino themed shows mm-hmm. with Latino audiences. Mm-hmm. Where the expectation is that he's going to do Latino material. And most of Al's Latino material is about how confused he is about his Latino identity, which is not what they want. They want stuff, maybe they want stuff about how, you know, Salvadorians hate Mexicans or something, you know?
That was inside. I didn't even know that was true.
Yeah,
something
along those lines. And like, and basically any like culturally homogeneous group has certain really clear expectations about what they want from performers.
Incredibly dogmatic and almost unyielding rules.
Right. Yeah. And you ran into those cultural expectations as a kid when you were the private school kid.
Absolutely.
And you know about what comedy audiences can expect from a performer, mm-hmm. you know, and how ruthless they can be.
Oh yeah. No, you know, very early in my career, when I was dying to get on stage anywhere I could, I would play some traditionally quote unquote black rooms, and I would have to do a lot of defusing right at the top of the show. I'd have to like explain myself why I talk like, you know, I had a material that was like why I talk like this, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, look down on anybody, and I'm not trying to be something I'm not. And I would have to really explain a lot of that to people. And it's so funny. On my show, Bill Burr came on, and we were talking about the fact that he worked a lot of black rooms when he was coming up, you know. And I told him, you know, white comics get a pass in those rooms because
Bill's a very ferocious comedian. He actually talked about this a little bit on mm-hmm. our show. Bill's a very ferocious comedian, and sort of attributes part of his ferocity to the fact that he had to be a little bit ferocious white guy in those rooms.
He just had to drill it down people's throats. But what I told him was, you would have an easier time of it than me because you're white. They don't have any expectations of you other than they don't think you're going to be funny.
Right.
With me, you know, with me, they're like, if she doesn't come out and hit, you know, A, B, and C touch points, like, she's no good. And, you know, if you looked at shows like Def Comedy Jam in its heyday, there were so many really funny, talented black comics that never would have gotten on that show, because they just weren't doing the type of comedy that fit that mold. And I never did. And, you know, look, comedy is about being great. Comics are, and I think, you know, a lot of guys who are working right now would say this, and I think Louis C.K. is a perfect example of this, and so is Bill. The only way to be truly funny is to be fully and 100% uncompromisingly yourself at all times on stage. People see and smell inauthenticity more now than ever. They smell an act. You know what I mean? Comedy is very different than it was even 10 years ago, where a guy could get up and do a character and kind of be in some mode. You know what I mean? And even guys who used to do that then don't do it now. So freeing myself of this idea that I had to fit a certain mold was when I was able to be my funniest. So, you know, I gave up on that very early on.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter, thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
You know what's great? Social media. So social. That's why you should follow us on Twitter at Bullseye and like us on Facebook. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Aisha Tyler, one of the stars of the animated FX show Archer. I want to play another clip from Archer, which, as I think I mentioned, is like pretty much my favorite show. This is from the new season of Archer, which just started on FX. Your character, Lana, is a very competent super spy, or at least what passes for very competent in a very incompetent super spying organization. And Archer, the titular main character, is... he's surprisingly competent, given how incompetent he should be, given his sexual addiction, his cavalier attitude,
his rampant alcoholism.
Yeah, his just general. He's sort of like what James Bond should be like, but also
he's really who James Bond is.
Yeah,
like it's like when Adam created the character, he felt like, you know, you look at this guy. He's always drinking. He sleeps around. He throws women away like toilet paper. But somehow he still kind of remains, you know, this hero figure. Well, what if if we really presented James Bond like in his purest form, that's who Sterling Archer is.
So in the first episode of the new season, we should say that Archer's mom is the boss of the spy agency, which leads to a lot of mother issues. And Archer's mom starts dating Burt Reynolds, the actual Burt Reynolds, not a character. I mean, the character is played by Burt Reynolds, but it is Burt Reynolds. And
it's so meta.
This scene is an argument between Lana and Archer about that very subject. And you will briefly hear another agent played by the great Chris Parnell.
You get off.
Cyril, I'm pretty tense right now.
Because of the Cubans or because Burt Reynolds is doing your mom?
What?
Yeah, oh, laugh it up.
I am.
Cyril.
Burt Reynolds is actually
Ow! Archer!
Oh, you broke my freaking nose!
What's that, Cyril? Sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of I broke your nose.
Bullying Cyril isn't gonna make Burt Reynolds stop shtupping your mom.
He's not doing that.
But even if he is, which he is.
No, he isn't!
This Cuban hit squad is no joke. So if I were you, I'd lay low in the safe house for a few days until we work out a plan to neutralize them.
Oh, yeah, okay. The safe house.
I'm sorry. Your words made sense, but your sarcastic tone did not.
Because there are no Cubans. Mother just wants me out of the way so she can do unspeakable things with Burt Reynolds. So nice try, idiot.
I love it that I'm the idiot.
What I love about your character on Archer is that you get to be the straight man for this horrible, horrible person. But your straight man character is also very insane.
Yes. Oh, she's incredibly flawed. But I love her so much. I mean, she does have to lay pipe occasionally. You know, Lana's always the one that's like, we've got to save the train from the runaway evil group of people, you know. But she
is that what lay pipe means?
Yes. Oh, yeah. In the business. Yes. Well, it has okay. other meanings. I'm sure. Okay. I'm sure you could disambiguate on okay. Wiki. But in my particular case, in the Hollywood sense, lay pipe means to just drive narrative. You know,
okay.
Lana was like, you know, remember when we met each other back in 76 right. in San Francisco at the bar with it? That's laying pipe.
Wait, but so, in 1976 in San Francisco at the bar, lay pipe means something different.
Yeah, so it still means that different thing in San Francisco at a bar
right.
now. But what I have always loved about Lana is that she is someone who is kind of not high strung, but she's very, you know, her type A tendencies get the best of her at all times. I mean, she's striving for excellence. She's surrounded by idiots, but you know, she drinks just as much as everybody else. You know, she brawls, she sleeps with the wrong people. She's desperate for, you know, she's kind of alternately casting men away and then desperate for affection. You know, there's a scene in season two where, you know, she gets drunk at a party at Sterling's house and then starts crying about why, like, they never had a baby together. I mean, you know, she's got all her own kind of set of problems. But she, you know, and she's a porn addict. I mean, she's a porn addict. She's a closet Republican. She has a lot of things going on. She's insanely fun to play. I mean, I can't think of a character I've loved more than her.
Everyone in the show is constantly remarking upon how huge her hands are.
She has large hands. And then people write me, I'm like, my hands are delicate and elegant. Thank you very much. They're well kept. My nails are clean.
Someone sent those cricket paddles.
I prefer high lie hook.
high lie hook.
And, you know, she's kind of crazily overly sexualized. You know, there was like a scene in season one where she was supposed to go infiltrate this boat with this arms dealer. And she just ends up like staying. She needs a break. She just ends up staying on the boat with this guy and like drinking with him and then having like this terrible three-way with Sterling. So she's got some pretty like fluid boundaries. So.
One of the things about voiceover, and I've only done it a few times, but one of the weird things is that you think that when you're acting, there's like one true feeling that you're supposed to express,
mm-hmm.
and that your goal is to express that true feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing voice work, like part of what you're doing is just expressing every feeling that it could be so that they can pick from amongst them and chop them up into little tiny pieces and put them back together. And it's a weird thing to like have a feeling about a line and then have to turn around on a dime and be like, but what if it was completely different?
Right. But on the other hand, yes. Acting with other actors is much more nuanced because not only are you having whatever set of thoughts and feelings your character's having in the scene, but you're reacting to other people's thoughts and feelings and their physical stance and what's happening in the room and what you're touching, what you're picking up, whatever you're doing, how your pants feel, you know what I mean? How wardrobe got them wrong. So yes. And with voiceover, it is a lot more like it's much more like a math problem. It's just like, I'm going to just bang on this until the perfect thing pops out the other side. And it's not so exsanguinated that like, I'm just like, just say it five ways. It's just like, maybe Lana feels this way about it. Maybe she feels that way about it. Maybe, and I just keep kind of going at it. Yeah. But I think it's the more you do that, the more that kind of trigger becomes easier to pull.
Excellent use of exsanguinated, by the way.
Thank you. You know, I'd like to provide an SAT word in every
You won Public Radio Guest of the Year for
that
one.
Thank you. I expect a board game or at least a tote bag from someone. Magnetic bumper sticker. You decide. I'll take anything. So for me, I really love the idea of getting in there and saying, okay, what is the absolute most hilarious way to say this? And then we'll play a lot, you know, and Adam will go, try it this way, or I'll say, hey, let me just get one more crack at this. And then sometimes I'll surprise them. Those guys have spent a bunch of time with the script before I get it. So when I can crack them up, then I know, okay, I nailed this.
There's something transformative that they do too. I saw Lee Unkrich the animation director Lee Unkrich once demonstrate how they put together a line in Toy Story 3, and it was one of Tom Hanks's lines. And I think we can all agree that Tom Hanks is a decent actor.
Well,
at least a solid B.
I mean, you know, the Oscars notwithstanding.
This guy's fair enough. and they showed him Lee showed him doing the line a few different times and then showed the waveform, the visual representation of the audio, then showed them cutting up this one sentence line into essentially word parts, not even just words, word parts, piecing the readings together. And then showed the video of those readings because they shoot video all the time because it was a Toy Story movie. Mm-hmm. So they're doing it for behind the scenes and whatever because they have a $500 million. So they might as well. And plus, you know, who doesn't want to look at Tom Hanks?
He's all day long.
One of the most beloved men in America.
All day long, an American treasure.
Yeah. And essentially, the visual representation of this process was so stunning, this transformation of these line readings. And you can tell on Archer that, one of the remarkable things is how perfect and tight and fluid the animation process makes those scripts. There's never a point where I feel like that beat was anything less than perfect.
Yes.
but you go into the studio, you do just your lines, you do them 1,000 different times, whatever, and you go through this whole weird sausage barfing process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, you get to watch this thing that came out of that.
Well, it's interesting. One of the number one questions I get from fans about the show, like when I do stand up, I get a lot of Archer fans, and they'll come up afterwards and go like, so do you guys all record together? That's the number one question. Do you guys all record together? Because that's how beautifully they assemble all those moving parts into one thing. That it's an ensemble show, and we're all together as characters much of the time in that show. I mean, it's essentially an office comedy with spies. And the fact that they're able to take these, all these moving parts and kind of mush them together into this kind of really beautiful kind of, fluid orchestration is a testament to how good they are at their jobs. I don't think they're doing any Disney level crap with the chopping up of the word parts. I think that any money that might be going to that is going to craft services and candy bar snacking at the offices over at Floyd County. But
I don't know. I visited there one time. I don't remember any candy bars.
Oh,
they hid them.
There's a stash.
Do you think they hid the candy bars
from
me?
From you? Yes.
They said Thorne's coming over.
Strangers.
Hide the candy bars.
Strangers don't get candy bars. That's just for the initiata. I think that the fact that people are convinced that all of those actors are always together in a room doing that show is a testament to how well it's assembled at the back end and how elegant every aspect of that animation process is, because it's a beautiful looking show. It's done very differently than something like Toy Story. You know, those backgrounds are 3D watercolor paintings. To avoid the Scooby-Doo kind of repeating background on a treadmill kind of a thing. And it's a testament to the vision of the guys that created the show, you know, Matt Thompson and Adam Reed, just, you know, incredible talents and had a vision for it. And I'm sure Adam, if he heard me saying this, would be on his back laughing hysterically. But, you know, they're you know, they truly created something unique, and there's nothing like it on television, which I say that everybody says that. But I say that without qualification. There's nothing like Archer on television.
Aisha Tyler, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Bullseye.
It was a joy.
Aisha Tyler is one of the stars of the just tremendous FX show Archer. You can catch it Thursdays on FX. She's also the host of the podcast Girl on Guy, which you can find in iTunes, and part of the CBS daytime talk show The Talk. In this topsy-turvy world, only one man can bring order to the thousands, nay, millions of things that exist. With his signature segment, Jordan Ranks America, here's Bullseye correspondent Jordan Morris.
New to the list at number 5, it's pomegranates. They're full of antioxidants, plus while you eat them, you can pretend you're a jackal on the Serengeti tearing into a water buffalo carcass. Rising fast at number 4, it's dubstep. It's hard to say what this is, but talking about it is a good way to relate to teens in colorful sweatshirts. Steady at number 3, it's staying in with a bottle of wine in a movie. Suggest this activity in lieu of saying outright, "It's been 5 dates, let's get down to business." With its eye on the top spot at number 2, it's Vermont. Who cares what else is going on here? There's buttloads of maple syrup, and that's good enough for me. Taking the top spot this month, it's Jason Statham. He's great at kicking dudes in the face while always staying super European-y. From the bottom to the top, I'm Jordan Morris with Jordan Ranks America.
Jordan Morris is a writer and comedian based in Los Angeles. He co-hosts with me the comedy podcast Jordan Jesse Go, which you can check out for free in iTunes or online at MaximumFun.org. Just be advised that it is spectacularly vulgar. David Hornsby's character on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is a defrocked priest who becomes addicted to crack cocaine, lives in the street, has his legs broken by the mob, his neck cut, and is sexually assaulted by a street dog. And he tells me, after the break, that it's sort of reflective of his real-life relationship with his co-writers on the show. That's when we come back in just a second on Bullseye from PRI, Publitatio International. Once again, MaximumFun.org and Bullseye are proud to partner with the SF Sketchfest, our favorite comedy festival in the entire world. On Saturday, January 21st at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco, we'll be presenting An Afternoon with Eagle Heart, featuring Chris Elliott, along with Brett Gelman, Maria Thayer, and Andy Blitz, and show creators Michael Komen, Andrew Weinberg, and co-executive producer Jason Wolliner in a lively and humorous panel. And on Friday, January 20th at Cobb's Comedy Club, we'll present John Hodgman, An Evening of My Expertise. It's an evening with John Hodgman, contributor to The Daily Show, former guest host of this program, host of the Judge John Hodgman podcast, and of course, best-selling author of The Areas of My Expertise, More Information Than You Require, and the recently released That Is All. You can find information about these fantastic shows at MaximumFun.org and more information about the SF Sketchfest online at sfsketchfest.com. Hey, podcast listeners, review our show in iTunes. It makes a big difference and it only takes a second. I'm waiting for you to do it. You're opening iTunes now. You're typing in Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You're clicking on review. Now you're clicking on that fifth star. Now you're typing in why this show is so great. Now I'm thanking you. Great work. If you already missed The Sound of Young America, don't worry. In honor of the launch of Bullseye, we've got a free torrent at MaximumFun.org of our entire recorded archive of The Sound of Young America. 15 gigabytes of audio and video, all absolutely free. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of audio infotainment, all free to download and distribute. Find it in your favorite torrent tracker or online at MaximumFun.org. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It would be tough to have a more undignified screen career than that of David Hornsby, and it's almost all because of one role. Hornsby is a writer and producer on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, an FX series about a group of friends who own a bar and do terrible, terrible things together. Things usually go badly for the protagonists of the show, but that, frankly, is nothing compared to how badly they go for the recurring character that Hornsby plays on the show, Rickety Cricket. Rickety Cricket has faced unrequited love. He's had his legs broken by the mob. He found peace briefly as a Catholic priest before being defrocked and spiraling into crack addiction.
Give us the money! Now!
Spent the money on these sweet-ass kettle drums! Look at these!
Those are trash cans!
Trash cans, Cricket!
Oh, these are trash cans? Then why do they sound like this?
You sold our drug money on two garbage cans?
No. I did some, too.
He has also had worse things happen to him, which I cannot talk about on the radio. Really, really, really worse things involving having his throat slit and street dogs. Maybe that's why Hornsby's latest creations, the two working-class high school boys at the center of the new FX series Unsupervised, are somehow so dignified, despite the fact that horrible things happen to them, too.
Dude, we can achieve anything we set our minds to. We just need positive role models to inspire us.
Yeah, we don't got no freaking guidance.
I know. My dad lives on a porch and drinks all day. I don't even know where my real mom is.
Who the hell are we supposed to look up to?
Dude, who's the most positive people we know?
Freaking fighter pilots, bombing enemies for our freedom, freaking F-15, freaking F-14, freaking Blackhawks, freaking stealth with night vision.
No, man, I'm talking about the baseball team.
Oh, s***. The baseball team's freaking positive as hell.
That was a clip from Unsupervised with David Hornsby as Joel and Justin Long as Gary. But before we get to Unsupervised, we're going to talk about It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. David told me that his character, Rickety Cricket, is kind of based on his real-life relationship with It's Always Sunny stars Rob McElhenney, Glenn Howerton, and Charlie Day.
And I think, you know, the Cricket is just is an extension of how they like to treat me in real life in some form, you know, like... You know, just to be the punching bag sometimes of jokes. And in fact, I remember writing one episode. It was third or fourth season. I can't remember off the top. I think it was fourth season. We wrote a colonial episode. It's a flashback into colonial times. And I wrote that one. And I remember writing it thinking, I just remember sitting there being like, well, it would be funny if Dee spits in my face, I guess, because the guys will really like that. You know, when you work for someone and you sort of know what, oh, I know they'll like that. And I'm like, I know if I write Dee spits in Cricket's face, then that'll get a laugh from them when they're reading this draft. So even though I'm like, I know when we get to that day, I'll just have a bunch of espaculate in my face. But I think it's an extension of what they find funny, and they like, you know, I'm sort of the button-up guy, so they like to just on me as much as they can.
Is it challenging to find new indignities for Rickety Cricket as a character? Like, one of the things about comedy is you have to top the last thing that you did. You can't go down in comedy.
Right. No, yeah, you definitely want to kind of constantly, you know, up your game with how he's... I mean, we've already blown his head off in a flashback episode. So it is I sort of see a degenerative arc for him, which, you know, whether we do or not, we'll see. But no, you always – it kind of comes off story first. We always sort of base in story and just what would be funny. We don't try to force anything, ideally.
But crazy-ass stuff happens.
Crazy-ass stuff, yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we've – you know, we've – I mean, the last episode was a high school episode that I think aired that I was in, and I had ringworm all over me. my neck was cut up. I got shot in the hand this season. So, you know, I'm always looking for new ailments. But again, if it spawns from story, you know, we look to that first.
You were already like homeless and toothless. Like,
yeah.
Let's point out that you weren't exactly starting from the peak of your game before the ringworm and the neck injuries and a shot in the hand.
No. And the guys enjoy it. You know, it's always what can we do to cricket this year? You know, so, you know, everyone pitches out stuff and, you know, we see what sticks and I just go along with it because they pay me, and it's an after check, but it's, you know, it cashes, and so I'll take it.
I interviewed Paul Feig about his show Freaks and Geeks once,
yeah.
And I was so impressed when he described the way that they wrote their single season of that wonderful show,
yeah,
which was that they had this staff of writers. And, you know, all brilliant writers, many of whom went on to even bigger things than that show. And they all came in and he like passed out index cards and sort of sent them off on a sort of mini retreat to write down the most horrible things that happened to them between age 13 and 18.
Oh, that's great.
And then they just put them all up on one wall. And then just anytime they were stuck, they went to the like wall of indignities, like the nightmare wall, and just pulled something down. And, you know, so the part in Freaks and Geeks where the protagonist buys a European disco jumpsuit and wears it to school.
Yeah.
Was it just something that Paul Feig did
when he
was in high school? He just did that.
That is truth.
That's
truth on screen.
God's own honest truth. And I wonder how comfortable you are with revisiting your adolescence when you're writing about adolescence for your new show, Unsupervised.
Yeah, myself and I write it with Rob Rozelle and Scott Martyr. We all work together on It's Always Sunny and have for a few years. And all we do is talk about high school experience and you know, anything from like, this kid died, you know, he was selling drugs and he got shot, or, you know, this girl.
The funny stuff, like
yeah.
The really funny
well,
stuff.
Well, but, you know, we draw from, you know, the you know, our show is about these two guys, these two freshmen in high school and sort of their very earnest point of view on a very dark world, which is, you know, ideally we're trying to portray, you know, high school as it is and how our characters react off that.
I think we've seen a lot of sort of crass and world-weary kids,
mm-hmm.
And adolescents, especially in animation. I think maybe especially because of the success of South Park. But yeah. Also, you know, there's just the kind of general, detached, ironic, world-weary, Daria, adult-like teenager that we've seen a lot of in the past 15 years.
Sure. I'd say Alan Gregory was as an example that
yeah.
was, I think, just on TV.
Yeah, exactly. And that can be really great
sure.
and funny, especially if the jokes work. Both of your protagonists are just the opposite of that. These are kids in a world of just tremendous pain, just a world that is just kicking them in the junk constantly. trying to figure out how to believe in the like wellspring of positivity that is flowing out of them constantly.
Yeah. The difference between, I guess, the thing that we liked that attracted us about the characters was just how optimistic they always were. They don't see themselves, you know, their father leaving and living under a porch or their parents being too old to even participate in their lives being a downside. You know, they see it as, in fact, in the pilot, he says, you know, my character says, I held my breath the other day and passed out. No one even came and got me. Like, you can do whatever you want at my house. It's awesome. So, you know, there's this sense of like, oh, God, these kids are going to, you know, they're going to kill themselves because they just have no one looking out for them. But the notion that they look at that and don't see a disadvantage, you know, they see an advantage. And, you know, maybe every now and then they might say, you know, right now it might be good to have a dad, you know, but oh well. But, you know, the positivity that they have, the other characters around them can sort of make that observation of like, man, y'all need a dad. Straight up. Y'all need a dad.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is David Hornsby. He's one of the co-creators and the stars of the animated show Unsupervised. It airs Thursdays on FX. It reminded me a little bit of one of my favorite shows, King of the Hill. And the way that both it treats a world that you don't get to see on TV a lot with a lot of sensitivity, the way that it relates sort of big, broad comedy to, you know, small social comedy and sort of lets them live together. And also, especially the way that in contrast to movies where everything is about a big transformational change.
Right.
TV is often about the tension of an in-between place, like adolescence, right? Like a movie about an adolescent is about becoming a man, mm-hmm. and a TV show about an adolescent is about how uncomfortable and weird it is to be in between child and adult.
Right. It just explores that theme. And they're always the same every week.
And yeah, exactly. But I mean, it also just vibrates with that energy. I mean, just because when you're an adolescent, in fact, one of the characters in your show says this in maybe the third episode or something like that. They just say, I don't really think there is any other time besides right this very second.
Right. Yeah. No, they live in the moment. You know, yeah, they absolutely live in the moment. And whatever, like, you know, like, dude, that was a great idea. Like, yeah, I just thought of it just right now. You know, it's just completely just no foresight into it. But the show is about, you know, that it's as much as we can with keeping it funny. Not make fun of anyone, but make, you know, try to portray adolescence in a comedy without being as broad as, let's say, a Family Guy, but having some of those elements. But when we were talking about originally, like, what's going to be the tone of the show? How big are we going to go? Are we going to have flashbacks and cutting to, you know, crazy pops and things like that? And, you know, what something like Family Guy does, or is it more Simpsons, where it's just like a big, broad, sometimes satire of society, or is it smaller, like King of the Hill? And it was, yeah, it was somewhere in between that. This King of the Hill with a little bit of Simpsons there, because we all grew up on Simpsons, you know, watching all those episodes. That's something that's, I'm glad that reflects that, because King of the Hill is definitely something that influenced us.
I don't feel like I expected feelings to be so central, because you have very broad, I mean, some of the peripheral characters, some of the neighbors and stuff like that are very broadly drawn,
sure.
Goofy, ridiculous characters that wouldn't be completely out of place on The Family Guy or another very broad, jokey animated show. But these central characters always play emotional beats. The jokes are never about jokes. The jokes are always about character.
Yeah, and I think that's something we took from Sonny in a way, and in a way it's very different than Sonny. I mean, we wanted some people that weren't selfish, you know, and out for their best interest. These work, but they're both, you know, they're all... Both of those characters in Sonny and Unsupervised are so driven. You know, I mean, these are kids that will... you know, they feel like they don't want to be considered bad. If they get in trouble, they don't want to be associated with the bad kids and be seen as we call it, the kids under the bleachers, the hangout under the bleachers and smoke. And we need to do something positive and make sure we're, you know, positive. And they join the baseball team to have positive role models in their lives because they don't have any other role models. They're like actively seeking out to make themselves better people or to help out their friends, et cetera. So that's what attracted us to that and how much heart they have, certainly. I think, you know, at one point, one of the characters says, I think my character says, a girl who wants to take drugs, and we're trying to get her to come out, go outside, go, you know, like, don't you want to go, like, sing and play or fall in love? you know, and like, and she doesn't want to, and I'm just, and he's, and I'm getting so mad with her, and I'm just so mad that people don't freaking like sunshine, you know, because it's like, it gives freaking life to everything. Without it, we would be with nothing. It's like, I know, man, but like, she don't understand that yet. So it's sort of, it's getting, they want people to understand their point of view and have that sort of that positivity infect everyone.
There's something scary about it and tragic about it too, because their poverty and their circumstances amplify the powerlessness that is inherent in being a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
That you have this incredible drive to be a grown-up and to exert your will upon the world, and you think you've got something. Like, you're not 100% sure what it is, but you've got something, but you can't do nothing.
Yeah, you sort of have handcuffs on as a teenager. You, in fact, we were just, you know, just talking about an episode about getting a fake ID, you know, and what their version of getting a fake ID is. And for them, it's getting a fake ID so they can donate blood. Because you have to be 16 and or maybe you have to have a parent's consent, but they don't have parents to like Mike's stepmom says, she don't want to sign no more crap. She's not my mom. And, not, you know, so it's for us, it's finding those teenage things about, you know, wanting to do so much, but being handcuffed by your age. But what is it that, how do they approach that problem? And I think that's something we learned from Sonny, is what's a funny angle for each character that really is indicative of their character. And we try not to hang too much on just jokes. I mean, you know, none of us are really, great just joke writers. So it's what's a funny character thing. That's just a really funny take on the world.
What kind of teenager were you?
I was a little bit more like, I was like the theater nerd in a way. So in a way, my experiences are very sort of specific to the guy that was doing plays in high school, you know. Uh-huh. So it wasn't always, the guy going to a million parties in high school.
It's the straight guy who was doing plays
in
high school.
Of course, the straight guy.
I can relate
man.
To that. So I know it's a specific.
Yeah. You're either like, if you're in this business, you're either that guy or that person that was doing theater from a very early age in a sense, or, you know, who's excited about, you know, doing acting or something. Or you're the guy that, you know, smoked pot through college and then just decided to write, and you're really good at it, and you had a normal, you know, upbringing. But
be crazy handsome.
Yeah, you might just be crazy handsome. Absolutely. My high school experience. I was kind of the class clown a bit. I realized when women were not attracted, girls were not attracted to me, that my best bet to get attention was through making people laugh, and use that, I would run for like student council or stuff like that, and just make my posters for student council would just lance someone else's prior election campaign, you know. So
so you ran parody student election campaigns.
Yeah, exactly, to someone else's, unfortunate.
Did you win?
I did win, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I did the same thing. I totally won. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thorn, the T is for leadership, was my slogan.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
We had, there was someone who had a series of just serious posters, and I decided to mock them. And
it really upsets the people who actually wanted to be on the student council. I felt bad about
that. Yeah, when you look back, you feel terrible.
It helps students, yeah.
Yeah, you actually
help other students.
I was so busy coming up with a, campaign angle that I'm like, I don't want this.
Yeah, I thought making jokes, I thought thinking of jokes and putting them on posters was fun.
Sure.
Because normally you're not allowed to put up posters around the school with jokes on them.
It's much like, it's much like now. You write something and you think it's funny, and then they want you to make 22 of them. And you're like, I don't want to do that. I just wanted to write that.
You had to get your friend Hua. See, I got my friend Hua to be the vice president. He did all the work.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, so that's like the sort of a Bush-Cheney situation.
Yeah, exactly. More or less. Well, David Hornsby, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
David Hornsby is a co-creator and star of the animated show Unsupervised. It airs Thursdays on FX. So there's this thing at the beginning of a sitcom called a cold open. It's the scene that grabs you before the credits even start. The best cold opens set up the episode, but they're also like a little sketch in and of themselves. That's because the credits of a sitcom are what introduces the context of the show and the characters of the show. So the cold open has to work with the plot of the episode, but it also has to work without any context at all. It has to basically be a self-contained nugget of comedy perfection, which is exactly how I would describe the opening scene of News Radio Season 2, Episode 9. It's called The Cane.
Hey, Bill. Something wrong with your leg?
Not that I'm aware of, but thanks for asking.
Oh, well, if there's nothing wrong with your leg, then why the cane?
The what?
The cane. The walking stick.
Oh, you mean my cane.
News Radio's cast was full of amazing comedy actors. But in this scene are two of the best. Dave Foley, who plays the boss, Dave, might be the best straight man since Bob Newhart.
Again, Bill, why do you have a cane?
Alongside him is like Phil Hartman, cane, a man who could bluster like no one before or since.
It's just like that old saying, everybody loves a cane.
No, Bill, I think the old saying is everybody loves a clown, which is what you look like with that thing.
The payoff here comes when the bloviating Hartman does this cane dance that is almost Fred Astaire-like in its grace and just spectacular in its banality.
But, Bill, you're not using the cane for anything. The cane should have a function. And, excuse me, can I help you?
Yeah, I'm looking for Chapman Graphic Arts. Are they on this floor?
The Graphic Arts place. Yeah, they're...
Allow me. You, my good man, are going to get back on the elevator, go down one floor, step off the elevator, turn left, walk down the hallway, and the graphic arts shop is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 doors down on the right. Just open the door, and you're home.
Thank you.
Just glad I could be of service.
And then he uses the cane to throw his breakfast at Dave Foley.
Bagel Dave.
Seriously, I could watch that scene every day for the rest of my life. Go on the internet, type in News Radio, The Cane, and live a better life. That's my outshot for this week. That's it for Bullseye this week. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones, our producer, Julia Smith. Nick White is our editor. Our intern is Colin Walzak. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use that. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, on Twitter at Bullseye, or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-up. I'm Jesse Thorne.
Production of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.